Way up in Harlem at a table for two. There was four of us, me, your big feet, and you.
Welcome to Glad Q&A number four with Mr. Timothy Gordon. Tim, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
To all listeners, happy Easter, Christ is risen. We're actually in Holy Week recording this, and it was only yesterday that we all watched the Cathedral of Notre Dame burn to the ground. There's a lot of reactions in the Catholic world from vindication that France had already lost the faith and that this was just a physical manifestation of that to really people crying who had never been there. When I was 19, I studied at the University of Paris, and I was shocked when I was 19 to find out that the French government owned all these churches. And so in that sense, I see God's justice. But all in all, I'm still pretty much in shock because of how many times I went there, so many times when I was studying at the University of Paris, and I really feel like Catholicism lost a child unexpectedly or something.
Yeah, I was traveling when it happened, but I was getting a whole host of tweets and texts and eventually saw the footage, and what a ghastly sight. And it's funny that YouTube used its algorithms and falsely banned the video temporarily because they thought it was 9/11. I think the algorithms get something right after all.
Well, we're going to talk today a little bit about USA and France, I think, as we see how religion intersects with politics in today's podcast. We're really glad to have Tim Gordon. Tim is a lawyer who graduated University of San Diego, but before that he got his bachelor's from University of Dallas, his master's in philosophy from Loyola Marymount, and his licentiate from the Greg in Rome. Tim teaches high school, he's taught philosophy, runs marathons, plays basketball, and most importantly, he's married with his sixth child on the way. Congratulations on that.
Thanks a million. Yeah.
One thing I really like about you and your wife on social media is how you both honor each other and build the other one up as if you were still in love. Are you?
Quite. We're that couple, yeah.
You know, it's funny because on sitcoms, you've seen this in the past 30 years, it's like the goal of the woman is sort of to bring this war of the sexes into marriage and kind of make the dude feel like a doofus. And I love how your wife on social media does the exact opposite. She's always building you up.
Right. Yeah. No, the reason that men on sitcoms and too many of my friends in real life are bitter is because they're being actively cuckolded by wives who are disempowering them and all that. My wife and I are, I don't know if we count as trad Catholic. We prefer the Latin Mass. I'm still not sure what that is, but I think we're a traditional couple in the natural law sense of the term. My wife is, she's all lady and I'm all man, as far as I can tell. And it works. Let me tell you kids out there who are looking to not get married for like 40 years after you started dating. It works really well when you know each other young, get married young, and, you act like a man if you're a man, and if you're a lady, you act like, dare I say it, a lady. It's a beautiful thing.
When did you meet Steph? How old were you?
I was just in college. I was 20, and she was 18. I met her a couple weeks before she graduated high school, actually. And she started dating my buddy, and we were kind of just in the same friend group, and she and I quickly became, like, best friends. And so we were best friends for a year and a half before we ever started dating. And that, too, I'll testify, works really, really well. We're really close. And I feel bad for the guys that get, again, sort of cuckolded into at their matrimony, saying this is my best friend to his wife, and it's self-evidently not true, but it's actually true in our case. It works really well, the man-woman complementarity thing, and men not acting like betas, and women not trying to act like bearded men.
You know, my parents were from Chicago, and there's a sort of a sardonic phrase in Chicago about politics, vote early and vote often, as if you could, you know, go to the polls numerous times, which they do because of, you know, all the unions and all the mafia and stuff that was running things in the 30s. But I knew a bishop who said that's really how you should treat having kids and marriage, the whole vote early and vote often, get married early and have a lot of kids early.
That's right. I wish we'd started having kids earlier, but yeah, that's exactly right.
Beautiful. You know, Tim is on TNT with Dr. Taylor Marshall. One thing I like about him, he sounds like Crush the Turtle on Finding Nemo with that surfer accent that you use. You use big words like deposit and fide in that California accent. So I can really appreciate that I'm learning words I don't know from a Californian.
From Crush the Turtle. That's a great answer.
Well, I do know what deposit and fide is, but I love how you said, I'll have Dato C the other day. on one of your TNTs. You know, I have some parishioners from my last parish in Florida, and they listen to both you guys every single day. One of them's from New York. He's a big fan of you, Tim, but he can't understand with that Lou Alcindor basketball card front and center in your office background for TNT how you could have a guy who was raised Catholic but only took the name Kareem Abdul-Jabbar after he converted to Islam.
It's a fair point, but here's the response. So I forget the guy's name. Are you listening out there, bud? I hope so.
Don't
sports and politics. It doesn't work. It'll ruin sports entirely for you. It's a little different with acting because of there's some subject matter overlap. But with sports, you got to keep it totally separate or you're going to hate all sports because all those guys are more, 99% of them are morons, and they're being politicized currently. So, yeah, Kareem, it's a shame that he took it that way, and he's really turned into an SJW, but he's the number one scorer in NBA history, and I have to respect that as a lover of the game. Duly noted.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when I was in, I think, eighth grade, I read the biography of Bo Jackson. Remember him? He was played both basketball and baseball, is that right? No,
yeah.
Baseball and football. Remember
baseball
him?
And football. 4.140, fastest ever recorded 40-yard dash.
Whoa, you know that?
Yeah,
that's incredible. Well, I think I was in eighth grade reading his biography, and I remember reading something in there that I had to go look up. Of course, this was before Google, and it revealed he was promiscuous, and I was just so crestfallen to find out these athletic heroes of mine were unchaste. But that was just the beginning of realizing, yeah, you really can't expect their off-court or off-field lives to gel with your love of their sports.
No. I mean, I said it like I'm some gristle, you know, cynic, but I do the exact same thing. I'm only saying that I'm not going to abandon actually a very valuable card just because of Kareem's horrible, idiotic politics. But it's absolutely right when you hear that these guys are cheating on their wives. Many of them are famous philanderers. For me, it dictates, okay, I can't root for this guy anymore, even if, you know, I'm an okay Thunder fan. And
how much is that card worth now?
That one, that's like his third year card. So I think it's like $40 or something.
$40.
But I'm not going to, the point, it's not going to kill me to get rid of it, but I'm not going to trash it just because Kareem thinks whatever, Kaepernick was right or something. But yeah, it kills you to find out that most of them are not faithful to their wives. They're fornicating, all that. It's disgusting. Most of these guys are bastards in their private lives, but you know, if you love the sport and the art for what it is, you can take the takeaway lesson, be ferocious on the field, not with the ladies.
We were down, yeah, that's right. We were down, my family, for my dad's 78th birthday. My dad and I were talking. My parents are cleaning out the basement. And my brother and I had entire seasons of football cards, baseball cards, basketball cards. And, you know, it didn't go up in inflation as much as we thought. We thought we were sitting on a gold mine, but, like, everything is missing. We don't exactly know where they are, but we had entire seasons of Fleet and football cards and stuff. And I mean, how much do you think a whole season of, say, a 1990 football team is worth now?
Not a whole season, rather. The problem is, yeah, an entire series. The problem is, everyone. I mean, if it's 1952 tops, you know, baseball, then you're in the money. If it's 1987 Fleer, basketball, you're in the money because you got Jordan's rookie. You got basically the whole Dream Team's rookie cards in there. But the problem is it's a generational thing. All the kids our age, I forget exactly how old you are, but
I'm 40, you're 30, is you 38?
Yeah, I'm 38, yeah. So all of the guys our age in between Gen X and whatever, Gen Y, we were all warned sternly by our fathers, don't throw away your sports cards.
Yeah.
And none of us did. So yeah, the cards stagflated in value, and they're all overproduced anyway. You know, it's the supply and demand thing.
Anyway, Tim's new book, Catholic Republic, that was number one in the history of religion last week, even before being released. Congratulations on that. That's actually what we're going to talk about today, his book, Catholic Republic, with the subtitle, Why America Will Perish Without Rome. The theme Tim keeps coming back to in that book is how, and listen up, now is where the rubber meets the road in this podcast. It's going to be our launching point for the rest of today's podcast. It's why America is a republic wired Catholic, labeled Protestant, and currently functioning as secular. Last week I did a podcast on the 1932 book called The Social Rights of Our Divine Lord Jesus Christ the King. written by a French priest, Father Philippe, and translated and updated to the English by an Irish priest named Father Fahey. If you listen to last week's podcast, the main gist of it was that every society already belongs to Christ the King and therefore owes worship to Christ, not only at the private level, but also at the public level. Very few American Catholics believe this anymore, and the few who do are mostly monarchists. And so what's fascinating about today's guest is that Tim holds the state can honor Christ by being a republic. You don't necessarily have to be a monarchist. And I was telling Tim before we started, maybe 50% of my listeners go to Latin Mass, 50% don't. Maybe they go to Novus Ordo. I hope I have some non-Catholic listeners out there. And so today we're going to talk about just really where the rubber meets the road on what the church has always taught in politics. So even though this is probably a little basic for both the Catholic and non-Catholic listeners out there, could you maybe give us a 60-second difference between what a democracy and a republic is, Tim?
Sure. Yeah, democracy versus republic in 55 seconds. I'll go one better. The democracy is direct representative government. Republic is indirect representative government. And what that means is that one way or another, either by basically everything on the ballot box being voted on directly, everything's a special referendum in democracy, even including the persons you vote for and you put in office, every ballot initiative, you know, the regulation. There's no difference between regulation and legislation, which we have in a republic. Everything is directly voted on. It's tremendously inefficient, and it doesn't really work. And also, there's no real place for natural law within it, because there is no, as James Madison says in Federalist 39, I believe, 39 or 51, there is no Senate which gives the cool and deliberate sense of the people, where they can say, okay, this is what was popular, but we're going to take it another direction. A republic, on the other hand, is indirect representation, where, you know, we occasionally vote on a special referendum or two, but except usually we elect representatives, and the Senate was supposed to be elected by state legislatures to make it even sort of another degree of separation from the vox populi, to cool that passion, the passionate loins of the mob, which is usually what they used to vote with, by the way. And we, you know, that was taken off by one of the later Teens amendments. So we got a little bit more democratic. But the point is, natural law, this is what I argue throughout the entire book, Catholic Republic, natural law is arguably at its best in a republic. Aristotle and St. Thomas give republic and democracy as inverses of each other. So Aristotle and St. Thomas each have three, this is key to my argument and against the so-called integralists. If you're a Thomist, which I am, then there are three acceptable forms of government regimes. One's a monarchy. It's not the only one ever here. Two is a republic, and three is an aristocracy. They each have perverted inverse forms. Democracy, as explained more by Plato rather than Aristotle, they agree on that thing, is the degraded, corroded, or as Napoleon Dynamite says, decroded form of a republic.
Get your own thoughts. A republic protects a democracy because if the democracy moves in a direction of mob mentality or totalitarianism, a republic retains some rights for the little guy. Is that correct?
Sure. That's the particular kind of republic that was envisaged by, you know, the 1788 through 1791 framers of this country, when we when the 13 states were voting for to ratify in individual state conventions. They had to vote 13 times, basically, because there were 13 states, to ratify this new constitution. It, you know, it would require 9 states to achieve the majority to have a country which would pull at least those 9 states together, between 9 and 13, depending if they wanted to join the new country, the new regime. And It passed by a very narrow margin, particularly in the important states. The two most important states is number one, Virginia, and number two, New York. Virginia is south, New York in the north. Well, the reason I'm going into this is because Virginia voted to ratify the Constitution by such a narrow margin at Richmond, 88 to 80, I believe the vote was, that a promise had to be made by the Federalists, the ones who wanted the Constitution ratified, to the Anti-Federalists, who included like James Monroe, George Mason, Patrick Henry. Some of my very favorite of the founders were actually Anti-Federalists, not because they hated the Constitution, but the moderate Anti-Federalists just thought that many of the problems which we've seen, the growth of government, federal government, would occur, and they said exactly what sections of the Constitution provided those blind spots. So it was sort of a promise by the Federalists to the Anti-Federalists to have a Bill of Rights, which are essentially taken off the table, governmental purviews, which are taken off the table, that are so, require such a supermajority that they almost never can be legislated on. And that's the kind of republic that America popularized, and so now it's almost standard, some form or another of that, of having Bill of Rights, rights that really, for all intents and purposes, can't be touched by government, or ratified, and that's what we gave the world.
And speaking of founding fathers, you hold that natural law is a Catholic item that the founding fathers of our country accidentally adopted from Catholicism and inadvertently made a crypto-Catholic republic because of that. Let's go briefly through your book and just tell us how this applies to these various parts of American life, American culture, American politics, and American philosophy. Maybe give like 60 seconds, a shorter 55 seconds than what you just did on these six chapters. So let's start chapter one, Declaration of Independence. How do you believe there's a Catholic foundation to anything in there?
Yeah, so basically the six chapters trace three stages in the life cycle of any republic. So the book is republic specific. Chapter one, what does the Declaration of Independence do?
Do you want to give those three cycles before you jump in?
Yeah, sure. So it's real simple. Breaking the old regime, since we're not creating new geography, we're using old land. You break with the old regime. That's phase one. Phase two, you make the new regime, which is writing a constitution. And phase three is really the life of the republic. I call it staking that new regime into the culture. So back to the Declaration, chapter one. The Declaration, as most people out there know, was based on violations of rights. Not many. It's essentially three. Life, liberty, property rights were being violated by Parliament. The Sugar Act, the Stamp Act, the Tea Act, the Townsend Act. And, on that basis, and again, Augustine, St. Thomas, St. Robert Bellarmine all say you can have a revolution if the government in a serious way takes your rights. So on that basis of abrogated rights by the government, a fourth kill switch contingent kind of right kicks in. That's the right of rebellion. And all of our greatest doctors who wrote on politics affirmed it.
And at the Klein signed you on, maybe you didn't have anything memorized, but I'm surprised that even Bellarmine talks about that. Can you remember just even roughly, even if it's not a direct quote, any of those saints on that?
Super direct quotes. Well,
it doesn't have to be super direct. Lightweight quote.
Algernon Sidney, who is kind of like most people know John Locke's name, but mm-hmm. Algernon Sidney was really the Whig of choice. John Locke was a Whig, an English Whig. Algernon Sidney was for a larger part of English politics in the 1600s, and then American politics in the 1700s. Americans called themselves the Neo Whigs, the founders. Mm-hmm. Algernon Sidney was kind of the guy before John Locke was. He was actually accused in his own day of ripping off Robert Bellarmine, his treatise on rights and government and rebellion. Yeah, because he was. That's really the corollary of the book is that Protestants, Whigs were very, very fiery Protestants. They don't have a basis for revolutions because they don't believe in natural law. There's no intelligibility to nature. There's no inherent morality in human nature, and there's no goal really of anything of reading rights in nature. Anything really?
That's interesting because a lot of the traditionalists who push back against you on some of these online forums, they even disapprove of the American Revolution because they believe that we should honor all earthly governmental leaders. And in their defense, I mean, Romans 13 says we should honor the emperor. I mean, St. Paul wrote that about, as I said last week, Romans 13, he wrote this about the Roman Empire, that it had just killed his savior before he knew it was his savior. So how do you push against that? Or what would St. Robert Bellarmine say about the fact that we're supposed to honor the emperor, as I think also St. Peter says in the Bible?
Well, yeah, he does. I think it's 2 Peter. Yeah, they're talking about the Roman Empire, which was, remember, there are four prongs to natural law, to just war theory. And one of them is, the fourth one is sort of a practical one. It's got to be a war that's winnable. You can't just start killing English lords just to kill them. That's what it would have been in Rome. So that's answer one against these guys. Answer number two is, essentially, if you believe in the social kingship of Christ, then, as you said very, very eloquently in your last podcast, it was great. Well, you believe Christ is not just the king of the other world, right? Christ is the king of this world.
That's right.
And it's the same quote-unquote trads who are whining about that, you know, the diminution of that principle, that have taken it to push this trend, and it is a trend, very far now, where it's rare that you run into a quote trad that will openly affirm the original American Republic. I know we're kind of known for scumbagginess now, but I mean, even 1788, 1776 was a genuine Protestant plagiarizing Catholicism nation. Thomas Aquinas himself wrote this third aspect of why revolution is a right. It's because when the laws of the land don't even approximately connect with natural law, then you're being commanded to do things like abortion, you know, fund Planned Parenthood. Thomas Aquinas wrote directly, quote, "Laws do not command regarding every action of every virtue. Rather, they only command things that can be ordained for the common good." He goes on to say, "Human laws do not, by strict command, prohibit every vicious action, just as they do not command every virtuous action." Remember, Thomas Aquinas thought prostitution should be legal. So there's a lot of crossed wires, I guess we'll be talking about later, and a lot of crossed wires between social kingship of Christ does not require a monarchy in every case.
So, Tim, can we jump into chapter 2, subsidiarity?
Yes, sir. Yeah, subsidiarity comes from the Constitution. Specifically, it comes from the rights that the citizens hold that cannot be reached by the legislating power of the government. So that's sort of what we call negative rights. If you look at Article 1, 2, 3 of our Constitution, it just lays out the legislative, the presidential branch, and the judiciary in such a way that they don't have the powers to really, in significant ways, interfere with life rights, liberty rights, or property rights. I'm talking 1788, not 2019, obviously.
Sure.
And also, there are positive rights, as we talked about before. The Bill of Rights are the only positive rights in the U.S. Constitution, but they reaffirm, it's a belt and suspenders approach to rights, and thank goodness that the Anti-Federalists insisted on them, because the negative rights have been read out of the Constitution. The government aggrandized itself in, you know, during the early 20th century after the Civil War, and so now all we're clinging to is the positively enumerated Bill of Rights. But basically, you're doing all that in the Constitution on the basis of the Declaration. The ratifiers, the framers, were making good on the promise decade before of the founders. 1780s were premised on the 1770s. You make the new regime on the structure of the broken promises upon which you premised the broken regime, you know, the old regime.
And my understanding, subsidiary means you want the smallest company possible doing things at the local level. You can either correct me or jump off of that to tell me, what does all this have to do with Catholicism?
The subsidiarity is just the name given by, I believe, Pius XI to the idea of localism, of local government. It means governing local. It doesn't mean buying local. So a lot of again, trendy distributists.
Gotcha.
I go to farmers markets. That's better than shopping at Walmart. That's subsidiarity. No, that is not. What subsidiarity is, if you take Pius XI, who used the term at his word, is governing local. And what this doesn't just include actual government. It starts, most governing functions should be the household father. In other words, a father can decide for his household what kinds of movies he wants his kids watching, right?
Yeah.
The father can view a movie himself. He doesn't need some corporate entity to tell him or some government to tell him, you know, oh, well, your kid's not allowed to watch this until he's 13 or 17. Most functions can be taken care of at that level. So the father as governor has the right of first refusal. The next valence out, you say like a church community will handle anything that can't be handled at that, you know, first family level, father and mother government. And then you get involved in government only at maybe the city or state level. And they own that level of government only gets kicked to it, those rights, which could not be handled at the more local level. And then finally you get to the federal level of government, and it literally is only the residuum of those governing functions which could not be handled, functionally speaking, at a more local level. So by definition, Pius XI says it's immoral to kick it out prematurely. Immoral.
You know, I'm more of a monarchist than you, and I'm sure I have some listeners who are even more monarchist than me, but in your defense, what we have to say is that it could be a lot worse. We could be in Germany, we could be in England. I'm sure you've seen these stories on LifeSite News where the German government and the English government, if you teach that same-sex marriage in your private family to your kids is wrong, one of those two countries, maybe you can tell me which one, is already confiscating these kids. So, you know, I just remind my listeners out there that the United States were still far ahead of Europe as far as maintaining the level of subsidiarity that the parents still rule the families here in the United States.
Absolutely. I think it's Germany is where I've heard two test cases, but absolutely. Also, the reason that Thomas and Aristotle are so wary of monarchies is because even though it's the best level of government when it's firing on all four cylinders, it drops to the worst of the three perverted forms of government when a king turns tyrant. And subsidiarity can go, if you go from a good king to a bad king overnight, when the good king dies, subsidiarity can vanish. Whereas in a republic, which is actually the kind of republic that I've described, is the mixed regime that Thomas and Aristotle admonished a way to hedge your bets, because we have three branches of government. One branch corresponds with monarchy, the presidency. One corresponds with a republic, the legislature, and one corresponds with aristocracy, that's the judiciary. So we do have a kind of corroded form of good mixed regime that Thomas and Aristotle actually ended up favoring, is a mix of the three. And it's a much slower corrosive process. So we've been corroding since about a little before the Civil War. Government's been growing large. And then after the Civil War, we got the 14th Amendment, call it a punishment for slavery. And that really destroyed the Constitution, according to most originalists. And so there was an acceleration in the corrosion of our rights and of our subsidiarity. But look how slow it's been, about 100 years, and we still can homeschool.
Now, this is a little off topic. We'll get back on topic. But there seems to be something kingly about Trump that, like, the left really hates him because he acts kingly, and the right seems to really kind of secretly like him because he's so kingly. And you think there's any truth to that?
I non-secretly like him because he acts authoritative like a king.
Yeah. Right, right. Yeah. Now, what can you say about St. Thomas Aquinas on democracy or republic? This isn't a leading question because I'm very ignorant on political philosophy, but does he say it's okay, it's the least bad of the good governments or the best of the bad governments? What does St. Thomas Aquinas teach on a democracy / republic?
Thomas teaches, like most things that aren't directly related to divine revelation, it just teaches what Aristotle teaches, that there are three viable choices. A monarchy, like I said, is the best when you have a good king. It's not totally clear whether a republic is second best or third best when you have a good instance.
Okay.
But at any rate, a republic, which is what we have in name, is one of the three good, laudable, praiseworthy regimes for Thomas and Aristotle. Now, as both Plato and Aristotle very clearly articulate, a failed republic becomes a democracy. It's a perverse, subverted form of a republic. It's very bad, but it's not as bad in terms of rights stripping by the government as a perverted monarchy. A perverted monarchy, you never hear this, according to Thomas, according to Aristotle, is the most dangerous of all governments. And this is, again, why Thomas ends up favoring a kind of mixed regime, which is precisely what we have. Something, it looked a lot like, you know, 1788, the ratification of the Constitution. It's called imperium in imperio. It's an old concept. Federalism, we have two layers of government working at once. And this is, I think, what we all really ought to spend some time talking about today is my fourth chapter, separation of church and state. The reason it works, so it worked, I should say, so beautifully when the republic was new is because there's a separate, it's following in keeping with subsidiarity.
Yeah, let's skip chapter 3 and just jump into that. Separation of church and state, chapter 4. What does that have to do with Catholicism?
Everything to do with this question of integralism. How do we acknowledge Christ as a kind of a social king, and all of that? The central argument, I just want to get it out once. The central argument I'm making in the book is not that every single American needs to forcefully be made into a Catholic, a confessional Catholic.
Right.
They really need to for the sake of their own soul. And there's a kind of encouragement that's being given, that's being winked at and insinuated at every point along the way by the natural law. But what every American already is, whether they know it or not, I argue, insofar as they acknowledge and accept and are and receive benefits from
the natural law,
is they are benefiting from the Catholic intellectual tradition, which is this refined, sharpened natural law. You raised this before we were on the phone, Father. The natural law comes from Homer, Hesiod, the Greek tragedians, right? You see a very blunt, non-precise, non-sharpened natural law there. The Catholic tradition took it, and, you know, in the patristic period, then especially again in the scholastic period, and really sharpened it, and it gave the world what the world knows about not just Aristotelian ethics, but also this concept of Aristotelian politics, you know, that gets sharpened in Thomas and Suarez and Robert Bellarmine. And that gave us not only out of the school of Salamanca capitalism, but it gives us the idea of limited government and subsidiarity.
Okay. Is that where it came from, with Salamanca in Spain?
Yeah, the Spanish Jesuits. It's something of a J word now, a four-letter word, but the Jesuits were originally fiery Thomists, guys like Suarez, Bellarmine, Juan de Mariana, and they were amazing. It was an amazing order for fighting the Protestants, and they developed not only limited government, the way Thomas, using the Thomas Aquinas' principles, Republican theory, capitalism, right-minded capitalism, you know, free enterprise, and the Protestants in the 17th century really just were plagiarizing from the school of Salamanca guys who were citing Thomas as there. They were rightfully citing Thomas, the Salamanca guys, and then the Protestants just eliminated their footnotes and their endnotes page and just took it all from those guys, and now the world knows modern Republican theory as Whig, quote-unquote Whig, which is Protestant, but this is all wrong. And so everything that's good in our republic is Catholic.
Yeah. But one thing I want to push back against him is that historically the founding fathers of this country in the 17th century got their virtue from their Anglican parents and grandparents, and this idea of natural law from everyone who is Anglican. But as you know, that went back 200 years prior to when everyone in their generational line was actually Catholic. So one of my challenges to your book is that to say that those founding fathers got virtue and natural rights or natural law from Catholicism, isn't this just saying that Anglicans really got anything good from the fact that they were all former Catholics?
Sure. I'm not so convinced that that's even pushing back, because the answer is partly sure. The other part of the answer is there's one spot where Thomas Jefferson lists the four most important thinkers for the American founding. It's insinuated that he did read Thomas Aquinas, but of course he couldn't mention that in this anti-Catholic republic, nominally anti-Catholic republic. But he lists both Aristotle and Cicero, which is essentially the Catholic natural law tradition that grew out of that. That's a code word for Thomas Aquinas, is if you say Aristotle and Cicero together, even if you don't mean it as by language. They were all reading it. And so the direct lineage goes like this. The four favorite citations of, in terms of political theory, of the founders and framers were John Locke, as most people know, the latest of the Whigs. A little before him was Algernon Sidney, who was directly accused during his life of ripping off, plagiarizing Algernon Sidney, Robert Bellarmine, which he basically was. Samuel von Pufendorf and Hugo Grotius.
Did you just make that name up?
Yeah, it sounds like a clown college, right? No, these are real guys. Sidney and Locke were Englishmen. They were actual Whigs. They're Whig party guys. A couple generations before the Whigs were northerly, they were Norsemen, I believe. Hugo Grotius was a Dutch jurist, and I think Pufendorf was German. He was Germanic somehow. And Hugo Grotius openly admitted he was reading Thomas Aquinas, and he was getting his natural law from Thomas Aquinas. He rejected the right of rebellion in Thomas Aquinas.
Sure.
Thomas Aquinas, who had robustly said, he who kills the tyrant to free his country is to be praised and rewarded. That's Aquinas for all
those
people.
Is that right?
Yep.
Really?
Yeah, that's more than what we did in 76. We weren't trying to kill the king. We're just rebelling and seceding.
You know, some of the pushback I want to give you a little bit on this whole thing, and the reason I'm going to quote some of these online forums against you is just because I'm pretty ignorant in the topic we're doing this podcast on, so I still thank you for coming on here. But some of the pushback is that you've conflated this notion of John Locke's natural right theory with Aquinas' natural law. The American founders talk about natural rights, but is this really what Thomas Aquinas meant by natural law?
Sure. Yeah, it absolutely is. This became a popular thing to say in the middle of the 20th century with the quote-unquote socialist Thomist, Jacques Maritain, who I think really misinformed a lot of these trads on what Thomas stood for. Thomas was a robust defender of a natural aristoi. He hated the idea of egalitarianism. He said that if property rights were equalized in the state, meaning if the state took property from some and gave to others to equalize them, then the polity would be corrupted. He said property rights were 100% necessary. He said, the quote I just read you, that you can actually kill a tyrant if you're a virtuous people.
Mm-hmm.
He also says, this is Juan de Mariana quoting or synopsizing mm-hmm. Thomas, saying that the state that takes away property is doing nothing more than committing robbery, and you're being ravaged by a ferocious and cruel beast. So Thomas is quite a small government advocate.
Okay.
He's getting this out of Aristotle. And he's quite he views quite capaciously the right of property in just look at questions 92, 93, 94 in the Summa, the Treatise on Law section. I'm not making it up. He says clearly, at any point, positive law defects from the natural law, a citizen may legitimately refuse to obey. And what he really meant was stripping away liberty and property rights.
And that's brilliant. But I think also along the same lines of this pushback, I mean, you admit in your book that enlightenment is divorced from God. Do you really at the gut level instinct believe that the Declaration of Independence was more formed by Christianity with the pedigree of Catholicism than the enlightenment theory?
Absolutely, yeah. I know.
Really?
I mean, I can prove it to you. Well, it's easier to evidence the idea that the Constitution is more influenced ultimately by the Catholic intellectual tradition than the Enlightenment.
Okay, go for it.
Well, I mean, for one thing, you know, the fourth chapter, which is what we're talking about, integralism, separation of church versus state, this concept
was so robustly exaggerated by the opponents of freedom in this country in the 20th century, and by this I mainly mean the Freemasons, who really controlled the Supreme Court in the middle of the century. At one point, there were 8 of 9 jurists on, I believe, the Warren Court in the, no, maybe it was a different area, 7 of 9 in the 40s and 8 of 9 in the 50s mm-hmm. on SCOTUS were Freemasons, and that's when the First Amendment, the so-called religion clauses, establishment clause, and free exercise clause, were reversed. This is so not an exaggeration that one can just look to history, the history of jurisprudence, and learn that after the First Amendment was passed, you know, which now is read into it, separation of church and state, that it's either eight or nine of the original 13 states had an official state established sect of Protestantism.
Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. Almost the entire antebellum period until the Civil War, there were states, they were dropping off because it was up to the state legislature. It was not up to the federal judiciary, the federal legislature mm-hmm. to legislate an establishment of a national religion. That's all. Mm-hmm. All the Bill of Rights means, Father, is until the Civil War, this might be a red pill for a lot of those trads out there, mm-hmm. the Bill of Rights were the first 8 amendments, which is really what we call the Bill of Rights. Number 9 and number 10 are a little different. They don't do anything specific. The first 8 were specific powers that the federal government, the federal legislature specifically, can't legislate on. State legislatures could legislate on those. Mm. And that's the genius of imperium in imperio, 2 systems of government, state and national, federal and national.
Had any states unofficially adopted Catholicism, like maybe Louisiana?
No, because the culture was so averse to Catholicism that even the parties like the Anti-Federalists, who I argue are really doing the most Catholic things, Mike Church, if you know him, he also
has the
same argument. He studied a lot of the same documents and come to the exact same conclusion. But they were still all, you know, it's a cultural thing. It's like cultural Catholics. You know, they say that they, you know, Fat Tuesday is a big day for them. They might not have gone to church in several years. So these are superficial cultural aversions and anathema and, you know, I don't know.
Allergen. Speaking of Mardi Gras and Mike Church, he bought me oysters at Drago's in Louisiana a couple years ago.
Oh, that's awesome.
Oh, they're so good.
With them?
Yeah, you know, I actually covered a parish for a year as a priesthood. I had to leave on military leave for a year, and it was a little bayou parish that did the 1962 sacraments, and that's where I got to know Mike down there. So, hey, Mike, if you're listening out there, thanks for the oysters.
He's a great dude.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I personally believe the United States is going to collapse, but I really like your optimism. Did you think this book could be used for purposes of evangelization of Protestants to maybe show that anything good they hold is already Catholic? Or, I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but besides writing a book for the sake of the intellectual life, and that's, you know, the church and I think maybe even the Greeks hold the contemplative life ahead of the practical life. So it doesn't have to be like a practical outcome, but was there any like kind of practical agenda of evangelization in writing this?
Sure. Well, it was almost wholly practical. It's the wedding of the practical and the theoretical. Open-minded Protestants will be converted because, like Peter Kraft says, we've made politics of a religion and religion of a politics. These are dearly held American principles, you know, liked and smiled on by guys like Pope Leo XIII. And they are those principles that we've called Whig principles in the founding of the country. And the Protestants pride themselves on limited government. They don't know the term subsidiarity. They pride themselves on natural rights, even though natural rights are a derivative of natural law, so they must reject it. It doesn't come out of the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And they believe in Christian virtue. Virtue ethics is Aristotelian, also rejected by Luther and Calvin and et al. So, yes, if they take their politics super religiously and they're open-minded enough to read my book, they will be converted. And any Catholic will be rededicated to these principles.
You mentioned Leo XIII. This is a quote I want to read from him. Quote, "Lastly, there remain those who, while they do not approve of the separation of church and state, think nevertheless the church ought to adapt herself to the times and conform to what is required by the modern system of government. such an opinion is sound if it is to be understood as some equitable adjustment consistent with truth and justice, insofar namely that the Church, in the hope of some great good, may show herself indulgent and may conform to the times insofar as her sacred office permits, close quote. So again, the key line to take away from that, the Church ought to adapt herself to the times and conform to what is required by the modern system of government. He says that that type of opinion is sound, provided, you know, a couple things that were in there. Anything to say about that?
Yeah, so Leo XIII, this furthers the distinction I was making between 1791 separation of church and state, which is what you'd call a very soft separation of church and state in original America, where the federal government wasn't allowed to come up with an official established religion, but the state governments were and did for the next 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
That soft separation, Leo had no problem with that, as far as we can tell.
Okay.
And Pius IX sent Jefferson Davis a crown of
thorns. Well, of course he would, because it's Protestantism, though. I mean, he would certainly want a Catholic government.
Sure.
But, yeah.
But we're just talking about separation of church and state writ large. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
We need at least one of the states to be a Catholic state, and we can all go there and meet up and have beers. But there's the distinction, and this really is what I said proves the case to those trads who probably haven't read up so much about this. In 1947, when you had 7 of 9 Supreme Court jurists, they actually acknowledge in the case, Everson versus Board of Education, that they are reversing the meaning of the First Amendment. Europe is the center of the world, and it was the continent founded upon Catholicism, as you know, but it was really, really, really frontally assaulted around the time of the French Revolution.
That's
right. The decades before it, you know.
Everything changed at the French Revolution, yeah.
It did, and before, you know, between 1717 and 1789 in France, that was the heart of it all. When the Freemasons formed, they basically formed to give something like the French Revolution, and to actually frontally assault the churches, cut priests' heads off, make people scared to be Catholic, and claim
that
they're...
As I said in my last podcast, this was the rebellion against God, the only country that's ever rebelled against God itself.
Right. Think about, like, La Salette and the Marian apparitions like that.
Yeah.
So that ends up, they ended up being more, I guess, efficaciously overturned in their Catholicism than this Protestant continent we live on that was secretly wired Catholic, you know, for better or for worse. We're secretly wired Catholic. The Protestantism has been stripped away, you know, in America in many cases.
How is that? How do you think that's happened?
Well, because Protestantism is secularized Christianity. I mean, Christianity doesn't work without bishops, sacraments, and churches, clergy and creed. So it's just slow motion secularization. That's a big part of the book also, the introduction chapters.
Mm-hmm.
Protestantism and Enlightenment thought are the two halves of the modernist coin, and they both actually object to natural law. Protestantism just does so wanting to stay, quote-unquote, within Christianity. Enlightenment wants to keep natural law to the extent that it can from outside Christianity. Neither of them can do it at all. But it turns out that the Catholic wiring of America, even though it was a Protestant country, somehow has weathered a less direct frontal assault, and so we remain the more religious country, even though we're the Protestant nation. They're the Catholic.
Interesting.
It's an irony.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Tim Gordon. We will see you next week.
Thanks for having me. I look forward to it.
Say I can't tolerate you, 'cause your fee's too big.